60.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Well, we had a primary election, or what passes for a primary election in the state of Washington, the jungle primary, the top two primary. I mean, it's a ridiculous system, but it's the one we're stuck with for right now. So, did I cast my vote? Yeah, Tina and I delivered our ballots to the ballot counting box last night, and our votes were counted. I assume, I haven't checked yet to find out whether or not they actually counted them in, but we delivered them in person, and they made it. And as the Washington State Standard puts it, the first round of vote counting in yesterday's primary is looking up for Democrats in the legislature, and it contains some red flags for Republicans. I want to talk about that in just a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're want to send an email, instead, is talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X, because we offer up a brand new poll out of the news of the day every day. Today, should citizen rights to hunt and fish and farm get state constitutional protection? Now, this is an idea that's coming from Republican candidate for Oregon Governor Christine Drazen. And I think it's a brilliant move. Because, as you may know, Initiative Petition 28 fell, I think it was close to 20,000 signatures short of being able to make the ballot. But that doesn't mean that they won't try again. This is the third time that they've tried to get that ban on killing all animals, on all predator control, on all varmint control, on all, you know, rat control, all of the rest of that was going to be made illegal if Initiative Petition 28 had managed to get a majority of votes, if it had made the ballot, but it didn't make the ballot. They didn't verify the signatures very well, and so they fell short. So Christine Drazen is saying there should be in the state constitution protection for hunting and fishing, and it is a direct response to the Initiative Petition 28 that came fairly close to making the mark. A group of Republicans announced they will introduce a resolution next year at the legislature to refer a constitutional amendment to voters that guarantees fishing and hunting access. I think it is a terrific idea. It'll be great to see if any reporters have the guts to go to, say, Tina Kotek and ask Kotek, are you in favor of having constitutional protection of the hunting and fishing rights of people who live in your state? I mean, either way that she answers is probably not going to work out well for Tina Kotek. It does work out well for conservatives who know the right side of that issue. So the X poll is, should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? Today's X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday, I'd ask you the question, should a surrogacy contract force a mother-to-be to abort her baby? 96% of you join me and a no vote on that. And the short story on that, a couple had commissioned a baby, like you'd commission the construction of a house or you'd commission a statue, except here we're talking about a human being. And then when it turned out that the baby growing inside the surrogate mother had a heart problem, but it was a treatable heart problem, the couple that commissioned the baby, and we don't know anything more about them than just a set of initials, they said, we don't want the baby. Terminate the baby. We want to start over. Well, the mother said, no, I'm not going to terminate the baby. And now the question is, legally, can they force her to do that, or can they sue her to the point where she will be bankrupt and she will be poor for the rest of her life? Should a surrogacy contract force a mother to abort her baby? My answer was no, and 96% of you agreed with me on that. Now, about the results of the primary. I mean, it's not necessarily going to make a conservative like me happy, but Senate Democrats say they are not only confident that they're going to hold on to their 30-19 majority in the House of Representatives, in the Senate in Olympia, but they expect to expand it as well. And there may be four Republicans in the House who are in trouble. And if that's the case, the Democrats could be within striking range of getting a supermajority in the legislature. If you think the state of Washington is in trouble already, and it is, because we've had a state budget that has more than doubled in the last 10 years, and as a result, they are spending into the poorhouse everybody who lives in the state, because state government is spending money faster than people can make that money. And yet, for whatever reason, there are a number of bad results for people. One good result is John Lee. Looks like he'll be able to go on to November. And then if he hangs on to his lead, he'll be able to win his seat back. I think John Lee is a good representative. You hear him on this show speaking about a number of issues, including the interstate bridge issue. And then there was the result where John Brown did very, very well against Marie Glusenkamp Perez. It appears that either of them got almost statistically the same amount of votes, about 37% each. They will go head to head in November, and already the Republican Party has cobbled together what I think is a very effective message to send to voters about exactly who Marie Perez is and why you should vote against her.
I think that we need to start adopting a policy of a slow economy.
Marie Glusenkamp Perez stood by Washington Democrats' income tax, killing jobs, driving out businesses. Seattle liberals donated millions, buying her loyalty.
We're actually, I would say, like pretty far to the left of our party on a lot of tax reform.
In D.C., Perez voted for higher taxes, nearly $5,500 more, every family, every year.
We don't respect working people.
Her words, her record.
Yeah, if you just hold Marie Perez to her actual words, she's a fraud and has been for the two terms that she's held office. It is time for voters to send her home, and I'll be talking about that this year. And in fact, if anybody wonders, well, would I give Marie Perez equal time on my program? Yes, I absolutely would. She has never agreed to come on this program. She has never agreed to answer questions, and frankly, I'm not surprised by that, because Marie Glusenkamp Perez, member of Congress, who I believe will lose to John Braun coming up this fall in the November election, she's somebody who stands for all the wrong things. I mean, number one, she questioned at one point, nobody stays up late worried about whether or not we're having people invade America over our southern border. And it turned out she was wrong then, wrong-headed. She has not given anybody a point of view about whether or not she supports Washington State's new so-called millionaires tax. Perez voted against the working families tax cut that was extended in the Trump tax cut. That's about $5,400 in tax relief for every average family out there. So she believes in higher taxes, unsecure borders, and she doesn't believe in common sense. Fortunately, voters will get a chance to send her home and replace her with John Braun. Back in just a moment. It's Wednesday after the primary election in Washington, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Homeowners making today.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, nothing sharpens up my focus on failed leadership here in the Pacific Northwest like waking up to unbreathable air. More than 2 million acres of forest have burned in Oregon, 500,000 acres on fire in Washington State. Portland now ranks as literally having the fifth worst air quality on earth. There's even one estimate that I just saw a short time ago that says Portland is now the worst air quality on earth, and that's saying something. Usually Beijing gets the top prize. Democrat Governor Tina Kotek begs Donald Trump to declare more than one-third of Oregon's counties as federal wildfire disaster areas, but she hasn't offered up much of anything to protect against future fires, which I think is Tina Kotek's job. Democrat former Washington Governor Jay Inslee blames climate change for the fires in Spokane that destroyed hundreds of homes and forced the evacuation of 65,000 people. Of course, the actual cause of the biggest of Spokane's fires appears to be arson, and they have arrested an alleged arsonist. But Climate Jay does not let the facts get in the way of a good global warming rant, because that's where Climate Jay makes most of his money. Meanwhile, clueless Multnomah County announced this week it's forbidding folks from firing up their wood stoves on one of the hottest weeks so far this summer. Gee, that's going to be helpful, ain't it? The burn ban attempts to protect against wildfires, but I think it would do a whole lot more good if it applied to the hordes of homeless who already generate more than 40% of all the fire department emergency runs, and they regularly fire up their fentanyl pipes with smoking supplies from the same county government that is banning burning by law-abiding citizens. Go figure that one out if you can. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll, which you can find at Lars Larson Show: should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection in the state of Oregon? The idea comes from Christine Drazen and a group of Republican lawmakers. I'm willing to bet the Democrats are not going to climb on board that effort, but I would answer yes, they do deserve state constitutional protection. You can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Yeah, find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, question of the day today, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Douglas writes in, Lars, whatever became of that converted 747 that could carry large amounts of fire suppressant? It's expensive and takes time to activate, but why not? Also on the same line, how come the state or the feds never copied it? And on a second note, here we go again with non-proper forest management. Thank you. Love the show. Signed, Douglas. Well, let me give you an answer. The 747 firefighting supertanker was created by Dell Smith's Evergreen Aviation. That was before the year 2000, so more than 26 years ago. And then when Dell Smith died and Evergreen went bankrupt, the assets of the company went to another company, and they ran the global supertanker 747 out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. They tried to get governments interested. The airplane was certified by the FAA. It had passed all the safety inspections and everything else. It actually fought fires in Peru. It fought fires in Chile. It fought fires in Israel. It fought fires in Mexico, and even did a bit of firefighting in California. And you're right, it was a major piece of firefighting equipment. It was literally the biggest firefighting airplane on earth. And per gallon dropped, it was actually cheaper to operate the global supertanker, the 747, than it was to operate the smaller airplanes. If you understand economies of scale, being able to put almost 20,000 gallons of either water or retardant on that plane and be able to rewater the plane in about 30 minutes on the ground, the plane was fast. It could get anywhere in the continental United States in about 4 hours. It could get to Alaska in about 5 hours. It was tremendously useful. It could be flown almost anywhere in the world. If it was flying empty, it could go up to 600 miles an hour. So it had all those advantages. And for reasons the U.S. Forest Service refused to ever explain, they would not hire the plane to do the work. Even though right now, in the last couple of weeks, you can imagine a lot of uses that 747 might have come in very handy. It no longer exists. They took all the equipment out of the plane. And the technology, while it's still around, it's not in any airplane right now. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
You know, I may have led you astray, and because of that, I'm going to suggest the Daily Grill today. And that is billionaire Tom Dundon, who bought the deal to buy the Portland Trailblazers basketball team. And then he told the city of Portland, you need to fix up the Moda Center. If you don't, I'm going to leave. Now, I had believed, based on what I knew about the deal at the time, that that put the city over a barrel. Only I think, based on what I found out today, and I have to give credit to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, it appears that it's Dundon who's over a barrel, and here's why. If he decides to move the team, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper reports the NBA may charge him a fee, and the fee could easily be $1 million to $1 billion. Now, my question is, if Tom Dundon says if you don't fix up and pay for the renovation of the Moda Center on the taxpayer's dime, then I'm going to take my team and leave town. If the city were to say, go ahead, leave town, it's going to cost you $850 million to leave town. Go ahead, leave town. They've got him over a barrel. Why not let Dundon pay the tab? My favorite post on social media, again about basketball, social media users are now calling on a WNBA team to sign a transgender French basketball player who goes by the name Julie Tatart, even though Julie Tatart is actually a biological male. Came out as transgender about 5 years ago, said he would not say no if a WNBA team reached out. He is 6'3" tall, averaged 21 points and 20 rebounds per game. Can you imagine what a shock that would come to the WNBA? They might actually forget about their hatred for Caitlin Clark. Back in a moment. It's Wednesday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. So a Portland city councilor who's warned about human-caused fires is caught illegally burning brush in his own backyard during a burn ban. Should elected officials know the rules that they expect everyone else to follow? And should I allow, as I have over the years, a certain amount of latitude by saying that liberals, well, they need to have double standards or they'd have no standards at all? Aaron Mesh joins me now, who's managing editor at Willamette Week. You can find the stories that he oversees at WWeek.com. Aaron, welcome back to the program, and tell me about Mitch Green.
Well, first, I just want to say that I consider myself one of those liberals who has no standards at all, just so, like, if we're categorizing.
And we are. We are.
Thank you. So Councillor Green decided that he would have a medium to large backyard brush fire on his property, which, if my understanding is correct, is abuts a natural area. And his neighbors called 911 to report large flames coming out of his backyard, and a fire engine with four firefighters on it showed up. This was on July 26th, so a Sunday afternoon. It was before all this smoke rolled into town, so I will say that, like, the weather conditions were not quite as apocalyptic as they are at the moment. Mm-hmm. And yet still, there are at least two, maybe three burn bans that apply to his property, all of which have been rather loudly proclaimed by local governments, which makes it all the more puzzling that he thought that it would be fine.
And by the way, let's skip right to the, and you got Councillor Green's comments or rejoinder to this. he wouldn't talk to you, would he?
He did eventually. It took a day, but he did eventually reply to us. And he said he pled ignorance. He said that he was not aware and learned a valuable lesson. In fairness, I don't know what else he could have said, right? Like, there are not that many options about what you can say in that moment. You can say that you didn't know and plead ignorance. You can say that you didn't care and plead vice.
Arrogance.
Or you can say that someone else did it and then have to have a very difficult dinner table conversation with your spouse.
But what did he say about the fact that he has been a critic? And I think you pointed out in the story at WWeek.com that this is one of the issues that he brought up when he was running for office and said, we have to protect people, you know, from the smoke and everything else. And then he goes out and does it himself. That even if he didn't know that there was a burn ban in place at the time, he certainly would know this is something you've complained about yourself. And now you're one of the offenders.
I think another way of looking at this, which maybe is too philosophical for noon on a Wednesday with smoke all around us, but another way of looking at this is that we often break things down into categories of like systemic injustice and personal responsibility. Like, to what degree is a thing happening because of the larger forces at play that create like the conditions that create dry timber tinder and are now imperiling Timberline Lodge? And to what degree is that anyone's personal fault? To what degree is it someone's personal fault that Spokane is on fire after an arsonist set a fire in a field of grass? And to what degree is that a larger force? I think my point in bringing all of that up is to say that, like, if you spend your time campaigning about wanting to fight the larger forces, that holds you, I think, to at least the same standard, if not a higher standard, of responsibility for making sure that you don't contribute to those larger forces.
Well, and I'd add this, because I've got a yard. I have to do cleanup. We also have a little farm, and we do burns, but we do them well within the rules. And if you're going to burn, you find out, is there a burn ban in place today? He apparently did none of that due diligence, which doesn't suggest good things about him as a government official. If he's not willing to even check and find out before he sets his backyard on fire, if there's a burn ban in place by one of the governments that he's associated with, then how well does he check any of the rest of his work? But he also lives in an urban area in which, I don't know about you, but I've got a green bin I can fill full of yard debris once a week and get a whole bunch of stuff pulled away as part of the cost of the garbage service I get, you know, for on a regular basis, regular household garbage. And they take away the green container full of the yard debris. He could have done that, but it's a lot easier just to set it on fire. So, in other words, some of this is about Mitch Green's own laziness, it sounds like.
I mean, you mentioned arrogance earlier, and while I can't speculate as to anybody's motivations or character, it is a baffling misstep. It's a baffling misstep, especially during this fire season and during an election cycle. You know, I'm being a little bit cynical, but like, if I were running for office, I would dot my I's and cross my T's even more than I do in my daily life anyway.
Yep.
It's just a very, very odd decision to make, and I think quite newsworthy.
Hey, I'm going to see if we can get Mitch Green to come on. I want to ask you about something else, because I know you're a Major League Baseball fan, or Major League Basketball fan, aren't you?
I'm a big NBA fan, yes, although my enthusiasm is draining by the hour.
I kind of admitted that I might have led my audience astray, because I understood that the city of Portland was over a barrel because of idiot Ted Wheeler, who took ownership of the Moda Center, and then the Blazers can say, hey, either fix it up to our satisfaction or we're going to take the team and go elsewhere. What I didn't know until today, and I have to give the Fish Wrapper credit for that, they may have to pay an exit fee to the NBA of $850 million to $1 billion. It sounds to me like if they want to, the city of Portland, and I want your take on this, could say to Dundon, hey, Tom Dundon, you want to take the team and take it somewhere else like Nashville, go ahead. It's going to cost you $1 billion. Or you could spend your own $600 million and fix up the Moda. It sounds like they may have him over a barrel. Am I right?
I mean, it's a standoff. It's guns drawn in both directions, and I think that both sides have leverage. I still think at this point that the most likely scenario is that you're going to see city council pass some kind of funding package in about 8 days, and that at that point it is extremely unlikely that that Tom Dundon's leverage is as strong as he pretends that it is. It is true. The Oregonian has a great story this morning about the relocation fee. I will tell you that I think that, like, within NBA circles, the reality of relocation fee has been talked about quite a bit. Sean Hyken at the Rose Garden Report has written about it. At the end of the day, the city could also sue the Blazers for an enormous amount of money, probably $500 million. And so I do think that one of the things that could end up keeping the Blazers here is, ironically enough, Tom Dundon's cheapness.
Exactly, because it does sound like he's kind of a skinflint. But in any case, that's Aaron Mack, managing editor at Willamette. You can find him at WWeek.com. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Vision. Do you have
if you're surrounded by Northwest liberals?
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Our X poll question today: should citizen rights to hunt and fish get protection in the state constitution? It's an idea that comes from Christine Drazen and a group of Republicans. Christine, of course, is the Republican nominee to be governor of Oregon, and I think this year she has an excellent chance of beating Tina Kotek, who's fallen out of favor with labor unions, teachers, and everybody else. But should citizen rights be protected? Initiative Petition 28 came close, but did not make the ballot. But if it had made the ballot, and if it had drawn a majority of votes, then you would have seen all kinds of things happening in Oregon. All fishing forbidden, all hunting forbidden, all animal raising for food forbidden, all pest control. I mean, the list of things that IP 28 would have done goes on and on and on. It didn't make the ballot. It doesn't mean that that group is not going to come right back and try it again next year and probably the year after that until they finally make the ballot. But in this case, should we see a constitutional protection of fishing and hunting rights? On that note, I want to go to Courtney Bangs, who is the Republican candidate for Oregon State Senate District 16. Courtney, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So congratulations, because you won your primary back in May with, what, almost 63% of the vote? That's pretty sizable.
Yeah, I just feel blessed to have the opportunity to serve our community. And, yeah, I'm excited and a little bit nervous, but definitely excited.
Don't worry about being nervous. Tell my audience what you want to do should you get to the Oregon State Senate. Who holds that seat right now in District 16?
Our beautiful Senator Weber holds that seat currently in Senate District 16, and I'm blessed to have her endorsement and her support as I move into this position.
Very good. What do you want to get done if you get to go to Salem? Because there are a lot of things I'd like to see government do, but I want to know what you have on your agenda to get done.
I would love for accountability and consequences to come back in style. I would love to be able to see our government actually serve the people versus have our current state government tell us what we're supposed to want and need. I just want to be a voice for our community and represent our citizens as they deserve to be represented and carry the torch forward. I think our Senator Weber has done a great job, and I just want to carry that forward.
Do you think there's a way to cut back the insane level of, I think it's an insane level of spending by state government, and I apply this to both states, Oregon and Washington. We have seen state budgets in both states go up far faster than inflation and far faster than people's paychecks, which means state government is consuming the population instead of serving the population. How do you get around to cutting that back?
Honestly, I believe addressing it at the top and work on consolidation and dialing back the weight of state government. When you see our employee rates or employment rates for state government increase faster than private industry, that means that economically we're upside down. And we need to flip that and really encourage our businesses and encourage our and create an atmosphere for our businesses to grow versus continuing to grow state government. I mean, it's, let's be honest, it's a little fat.
You think?
Yeah, it's a little fat. And when you see...
Hold on, did we just lose Courtney Bangs? Let's see if we can get her back on. I don't know what happened to her phone. Joel, would you mind checking, see if she's still on that line? If not, we'll reconnect to her, but sounds like her phone dropped off, but we'll call her back. That's Courtney Bangs, the Republican candidate for Oregon State Senate District 16. She got almost 63% of the vote in the primary, and that means she should do reasonably well. Tell me about the Democrat you're going to be running against in November, Courtney.
Her name is Rachel Armitage. I don't actually know a whole lot about her. She did serve our community for 22 days as an appointment when Betsy Johnson chose to run for governorship.
Okay. And what do you know about her positions on the issues, if anything at all?
I don't honestly know anything at all. I've been looking for her to have an opinion on what is happening to our communities, but I've yet to see a strong stance of any sort.
I mean, does she have a website? Does she explain what her positions are on the various issues? Because that might be the best way for you to go after her between now and November, is say, she believes in higher taxes, I believe in lower taxes, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Well, I'll be frank, she's endorsed by some entities that concern me, so I already have an idea of the direction that
is she one of those is she one of those DSAs by any chance?
I sure oh goodness,
Democrat Socialist.
Yeah, I can neither confirm nor deny that statement, but I do know that Indivisible North Coast are Indivisible does support her, and that causes me some pretty deep concern.
All right. Tell people where to find your social media so they can find out about your campaign between now and November, Courtney.
Absolutely. So my website is CourtneyBangs.com, and I'm also present on Facebook and Instagram under the name Courtney Bangs. It's really hard to not find me, so just Google, and I'll appear.
You know what I wish candidates like you would do? I wish you'd make, say, Instagram videos. Do a 60- or 90-second video. Just talk to the camera and say, look, I'm going to take a subject. I don't know where my opponent is going to be, and name her. And then say, but here's where I am on taxes. Here's where I am on a bloated ODOT that has 5,000 employees but doesn't actually build new freeways and bridges. Here's where I am on, IP-28. And then throw down the challenge to your competitor and say, we don't know where she stands on this, and I'm challenging her or the people who plan to vote for her to tell us. Where do you stand on these issues? You know, where do you stand on sanctuary state status for illegal alien criminals? You know, where do you stand on locking criminals up and having tough consequences when people commit, say, violent crimes? And throw that, if you did one of those a day between now and November, imagine how many voters do you think you'd be able to get talking about your campaign. That's Courtney Bangs running for the Oregon State Senate District 16. Courtney, thanks so much for the time. This segment of the show brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids up for success. Create a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. One of the things we've been talking about a lot in this election year, because we've already had primary elections yesterday in Washington State, a couple of months ago in the state of Oregon, and we have a general election coming up in November. And it's a midterm election, so not as important as the one in which we choose the president, but still very, very important when it comes to various election issues. And one of the issues we've had to deal with is whether or not the people signed up to vote are actually eligible voters. Are they American citizens? Are they legally registered? Are they living in the United States legally? Are they citizens? And if you can't get those answers, then you know we have a problem. And we already know that around the United States, the White House has identified more than 250,000 illegal voters who are foreign nationals who are signed up to vote. State of Oregon has also identified a number of foreign nationals. And when that happened, a lot of us started to ask, who's paying attention to who gets signed up to vote? And then I got a great example of where the system does not seem to be paying much attention at all. And it came in from Terry, who joins me on the phone right now. Terry, we've agreed to withhold your last name, but I want you to tell me what happened to your sister and about her circumstances when she got signed up to vote. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Thank you. Hey, I have a young sister who, well, she's 58 now, and she's intellectually delayed, and I'm her guardian. Every year we take a trip down to Disneyland, and back in 2023, we went down to get her a ID, and of course we had to get the real ID because we got to fly. And when I went down there, we got her all, you know, situated, and we leave not much longer than that. We had a vote, and she received a ballot in the mail. And the ballot was for her to vote. And like I said, her mentality or intellectuality mentality is 46 years old. So just
by the way, I want people to take note of that. You didn't say 46. You said 4 to 6 years old. Is that right? Looks like Terry's phone dropped. We'll get her phone call back on. But she had written to me saying, I took my special needs sister to DMV to get a real ID so we could travel to Disneyland and have her identification. My sister has the mentality of about a five-year-old. And Terry, all I wanted to make sure was that people didn't say here 46-year-old. You said 4 to 6-year-old. And she got signed up to vote. Was there at any point in the process, did the DMV say to you, do you want your sister signed up to vote?
Not at all. Nope. I actually called them back. And they said that at that time, they register everybody when they, you know, get their ID or their driver's license renewed. And then I later found out just through reading that this started back in 2016. And it was something initiated by Kate Brown. She actually signed it.
And yeah, motor voter.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where this was all initiated from. So what changed was now it eliminates us having to fill out a registration, and it puts us in a position where you either opt in or opt out. If you choose not to, you know, respond to anything from the Secretary of State's office, you end up opting in to a nonpartisan ballot.
Well,
coming, you know, for her to vote.
I want to make sure you say that the right way, because if you get a driver's license, they automatically sign you up to vote unless you say, do not sign me up to vote. Is that the way it works?
From my understanding, is it forces you to either opt out by getting a hold of the Secretary of State's office to opt out. So you're automatically opted in.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's what I understood, is you're automatically signed up to vote unless you say otherwise. And the end result of that is they found a couple of thousand people who are foreign nationals that were registered to vote, when in fact it's a felony to register to vote if you're a foreign national.
Right, right. Yeah, in this case, it was the mentality. You know, how many people are getting ballots if they're a guardian of somebody whose mentality is less than, you know, able to make decisions? And that's what kind of caught my attention on this, was there could be several ballots out there that are filled out by family or guardianships that we don't even know about.
Because who's going to be the wiser if a family member fills out that ballot and sends it in? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly is a problem. And, I, you know, down the road, I'm just seeing some steps that need to be taken to amend that House bill. It just makes no sense.
No, and the concern I've got is, I know somebody is going to say, well, what about the person who, say, has Downs but does desire to vote? Do they have a right to vote? They do. The system cannot say, no, you have to have a certain mentality to be able to vote. They're allowed to vote if they choose to. But in your case, you're saying your sister was signed up to vote and she didn't even know she was being registered to vote or that she was going to get a ballot. And somebody who's less than honest could have said, well, I'll just fill it out for my sister. I'm sure she would have wanted Kate Brown, Tina Kotek to be reelected or whatever.
Could happen, you know, and the potential is there. It's a sad situation. And like I said, you know, it needs to be amended.
Yeah, and I guess the only question I'd have is, what do you suppose is the likelihood that a state in which every statewide office is filled with a Democrat, there are super majorities of Democrats in the House and the Senate, and there's a Democrat in the governor's office, what do you suppose is the chance that that law is going to be amended, since this seems to benefit the Democrat Party?
Well, it's probably not, and I understand that, but I've got Kevin Mannix on my side. He's my rep, and, you know, I'm just pushing for this to be changed. It's just such a problem, you know, and DMV should not be doing that.
No, they shouldn't be doing it at all. Terry, I really appreciate you sending me that note. It alerted me to that. Let me go to Jeff in Seattle. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Trump. At first it was, you know, portray himself as Jesus. Now you got a picture out here on True Social of him as in a four-star general outfit between MacArthur and Patton. He's a draft-dodging coward. President Bonespurge. And that's stolen valor right there. I mean, he's got medals on his chest that aren't even Army. He's got wings on his chest. He's got a
Who made that picture,
below.
By the way, Jeff?
What?
Who made that picture? Because it was uploaded by somebody other than Donald Trump.
It was on Truth Social. It's on Truth Social.
Most of what is on Truth Social is not posted by Donald Trump. It's posted by everybody else, including yours truly, who use Truth Social. You are aware of that, aren't you?
Yes, but he put it up there. Nobody's taking it down. He's taking credit for it. You can divert, deflect all you want.
And you think it's stolen valor for the guy who is literally the commander-in-chief of all the United States military forces to be depicted in a uniform? Okay, interesting attitude. Jeff, you should definitely call in on First Amendment Friday.
Over in Northeast Portland.
At the KXL News Desk with your Wednesday.
Your commercial property.
Taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got a question for you. If you were the prosecutor, would you have brought criminal charges against this dad, the dad I'm about to describe, defending his daughter? His daughter, by the way, is 11 years old, and his name is Malik Chandler. And this happened in July. It happened last month in Ohio. Here's what happened, and then I'm going to ask you whether or not you would have brought charges against the dad. So it turns out that the 11-year-old girl had already been sexually assaulted by a 20-year-old man by the name of Diego Montoya Gonzalez. And the dad found out about what was happening. Mom found out as well. And he decided to take action. I'll tell you what happened in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And we always try to make this the best conversation in talk journalism. So if you want to join the conversation, that's easy enough. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, well, naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our ex-poll question today, should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? I would answer that one yes. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to Malik Chandler, 31 years of age. He has an 11-year-old daughter. And what happens? Well, one day last month, he finds out that there is a video on his daughter's phone that shows an adult man, Diego Montoya Gonzalez, 20 years of age, sexually assaulting this 11-year-old girl. The mother discovers the video on the daughter's phone. And then dad finds out about it. That's Malik Chandler. So what does dad do? Dad decides that he's got to take action. So he goes on TikTok on her phone and he poses as his 11-year-old daughter and he lures her alleged rapist to the home to be able to take some action against him. Now, he tells the police that all he was planning to do was get Diego Montoya Gonzalez, 20, to show up at his house, thinking that he was there to meet this 11-year-old girl. And instead, it's dad, and that he was going to put a beat down on the guy. Well, it didn't go that way. And instead, investigators said that when Montoya Gonzalez showed up at the home, the dad, Malik Chandler, says the sicko reached for a gun in his pocket, so he picked up his gun off the counter, and he opened fire. Now, he shot Montoya Gonzalez twice. And unfortunately, Montoya Gonzalez survived. When the police got there, they found this creep sitting in a chair with two gunshot wounds. He was taken to a medical center in Columbus, Ohio, and he was charged with felony assault. This is Chandler, the dad, was charged with felony assault. And get this, the man where the video shows him raping an 11-year-old girl, the police examine his phone. They find other videos, several videos on his phone, showing him abusing children, including one clip of him abusing an infant or a toddler. They haven't determined which. He's charged with various crimes, sexual crimes, pandering, sexually oriented material, two counts of rape, one count of obstruction. So he's charged. His bail is set at $70,000. The father, Malik Chandler, the guy who lured the assailant, the man who had assaulted his 11-year-old daughter sexually and made a video of it, he's charged with criminal assault, and his bail is set 50% higher at over $100,000 for him to be able to bail out. Montoya Gonzalez, indicted by a grand jury on Friday, last Friday, of five counts of pandering and sexually oriented material. Prosecutors say the videos that they found showed sexual abuse of children, including Malik Chandler's daughter, his 11-year-old daughter, that, the video was discovered by mom. Now, what troubles me about this is I think to some extent the prosecutor may feel that the law locks him into a box and says, I've got to bring some charges against this guy. He shot a man. He shot him in apparent self-defense. It sounds like he's going to offer up a self-defense motive, saying the guy reached for a gun, I shot him first, but he did not shoot and kill him. He just shot him until the threat was gone. I think in that case, the father has a pretty decent chance of getting off, but if I'd been the prosecutor, I'd have been tempted, if I could do it legally, to say I'm not going to charge him with anything at all. What would you do if you were the prosecutor? 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me go to Wes. Hey, Wes, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. I was just calling about my frustration with Senator Thune.
Boy, you and me both.
Gosh dang it. It's like, first off, he can't seem to get the SAVE Act off over the finish line.
Nope.
And then secondly, we already know what the Democrats are going to do if they get power, right? Eliminate the filibuster, pack the court, statehood for the Dominican Republic, for D.C. probably. Why aren't we doing these things?
I've been asking the same question myself, Wes, because Thune's, his excuse is saying we don't have the votes. Why doesn't he go out and use the bully pulpit? Say, these are the members of the U.S. Senate that are refusing to go along with this. And whether Murkowski from Alaska, whether or not it's Collins from Maine, no matter what, if you say, we keep telling the public that if you'll just give us a majority in the House, we'll get things done. A majority in the Senate, we'll get things done. Give us a president in the White House who will sign legislation, we'll get things done. You've got all three of those. You're getting nothing done.
And here's the thing. Trap them into a talking filibuster.
Yeah.
Like, if they want a filibuster, you go ahead. Like, you go ahead. You knock yourself out for a week. I don't care. But, you're gonna eventually cave in.
You would think so. And frankly, I think the filibuster is un-American and unrepresentative. It's saying to Americans, even when you have a majority of senators, you can't pass something. Well, why not? Well, because of the rules. Who wrote the rules? The Senate wrote the rules. Really?
Right.
So in other words, the Senate could change the rules anytime you want. And you're telling me that when a majority of Americans have a majority of senators in favor of a piece of legislation, that we can't get that piece of legislation passed? Does that sound like representative government to you? Because it sure doesn't to me. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news. Dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And one of the reasons I love our visits with Leland Vitter, the host of On Balance with Leland Vitter and Chief Washington Anchor at News Nation, is because I read war notes on a daily basis. And I loved the note yesterday as we headed up to last night's elections that were held in various places around the country, including my home state of Washington State, where I cast my ballot. 2 years ago, Democrats were warning that a Trump victory would mean we would never have an election again. Pretty dire warnings. And he says now the socialists are winning elections. Leland, welcome back. And what does all that say about where America sits right now?
Well, Lars, I think you and I sometimes agree, sometimes don't, but we can both agree that the very best thing for America is America being America.
Yep.
And whatever you think about our current politics, elections are one of the great parts about America. One of the things that make America great is that the pendulum swings back and forth, and eventually we all move forward together. So I'm glad we had elections because, if you listen to everybody a couple of years ago, I would have been worried. I think what I've gained from watching what's happened in Michigan and the socialist revolution around the country so far is two things. One, that neither party is willing to moderate right now. Both parties keep becoming more distilled versions of themselves. There's reasons for that. And number two, that the socialist movement in the Democratic Party, is un-American. They hate America. The thing that the Islamists, of whom Abdul Al-Sayed is one of them, and Zohran Mandami is another, and the overeducated, downwardly mobile socialists have in common is they view America as evil in one way or another. Second point to make on that is, and we saw this in Michigan, extraordinarily tight race, basically 50-50. But it really isn't, and that's what we're going to get in on the show tonight and in War Notes as well. Be like Lars, warnotes.com to subscribe for free. And I had to get that in. Sorry, thank you.
I appreciate it. And Born Lucky, author of Born Lucky, an Audible book now available 40% off.
You see, you do it for me. So, but what's interesting is it's not 50-50. It was really 80-20 based on the county in Michigan. 80% for Abdul al-Sayed, 20% for Haley Stevens, or the reverse. And you would think, because Abdul al-Sayed, the socialist, is championing working-class Americans, it would be the poor, less educated, working-class counties that would vote heavily for him. Not the case. It is the county with the University of Michigan and the county of Michigan State. Only thing Michigan State and Michigan agree on is socialism. But it is the overeducated and largely wealthier, if you want to call them that, group of Democrats that want to institute these policies, whereas the working class, A, knows they don't work, and B, they're the ones who actually need government to work for them, and they realize socialism doesn't.
No, and socialism doesn't, and what strikes me is the people who seem to be against capitalism are the ones who are already sitting in a comfortable spot. That is, they already have their university position, either as a professor or as a student, and they say, I like this. And they can talk about socialism all day long, except that it doesn't actually affect them directly. And when you ask them the reasonable question, tell me somewhere on planet Earth where socialism actually works, you know, they'll name things like, European countries like Norway. And you say Norway is not a socialist country. It's a capitalist country with a fat welfare state, but it's not a socialist country. Venezuela is. Cuba is. You know, there are places socialism usually runs well under dictatorships, and then it doesn't do any favors for the people who live in it. And yet there are people in America, some of the allegedly best educated people in America, who seem to love the idea, except I don't think they know what it is that they're in favor of. Do you? Leland? Did we lose Leland? Oh, gosh. This is irritating. Hey, Joel, would you check and see if you can get Leland? I don't know if he just disappeared or if I just talked too long. Let's see if we can get him back on the line. But that's the concern you've got. I mean, he says the new reality is the Democratic base is now fully controlled by the socialist and the communist left. You know, that's where we're headed right now, isn't it, Leland?
Well, the Democratic Party certainly fears that control. It's pretty interesting, and I'm an analyst, not a partisan, and a journalist above all. But the Democrats are trying to put in a bulwark against the socialist takeover, the DNC is, which is kind of funny because they're the party of democracy, yet they want to try to take the Democratic vote away from their own people. But they're trying to maneuver the situation. For example, they've moved the first primary in the nation for Democrats away from Iowa and away from New Hampshire that are much bluer to South Carolina, where you have a much larger African-American vote, which is a much more traditional Democratic base, which obviously is what got Joe Biden the presidency or the nomination. So I think that kind of speaks to how scared Democrats are of this takeover.
But what's going to happen when the mainstream Democrats are going to be forced to answer, I guess, to voters, are you going along with this socialism, communism stuff? And their choice is reject their own party
terrified.
Or what?
Right. Well, what I think is funny is Chuck Schumer sitting there saying how it's such a big tent, right? You know, even though Abdul al-Sayed and everybody else says we're coming for Chuck Schumer. I made the point last night, pretty soon Chuck Schumer is going to be a guest in his own tent. and that's really, I always love it when I get Lars to laugh a little bit. It's hard. But I know I've practiced my lines well, but that's where this is headed. Unquestionably. And by the way, it's no different than the normie Republicans who are now guests in the MAGA tent, right?
It's
the same thing that's happened. And the normie Republicans kind of hold their nose and have to answer for Trump, but they do it because they know that's the only game in town. And the normie Democrats will do the same thing with the socialists.
Yeah, except I just wonder how they think it's going to work out long term. Even Mamdani, you know, this crazy grocery store idea of his. Yeah, we're going to go out and have the government sell groceries at 30% below the cost of every bodega in Manhattan. And then we're going to wipe out the entire private sector. And then we're going to have the government sector be the only choice in town when it comes to groceries. Oh, and by the way, you don't need picture ID to vote, but you do need it to be able to go down and buy dinner.
Well, socialism is great until you run out of other people's money. And if
That is, the thing is, there's very few things in life that are totally predictable, right? Death is, taxes are, okay, you know, a mother's love. There's very few things that are predictable. It is unquestionable in human history how socialism ends, right? We yep. know that. It's never we ended know. Any differently. You can nope. go to Venezuela, you can go to Cuba, you can go to Russia, and you see exactly what happens with socialism.
And it only works at the point of a gun. That is Leland Vitter, the author of Born Lucky, also War Notes, and chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, thanks for the time. Back in a moment, you've got the Lars Larson Show. Headline Fields.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday live on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our email of the day, and you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Douglas writes, and Lars, whatever became of that converted 747 that could carry large amounts of fire suppressant or water? It's expensive and takes time to activate, but why not? Also on the same line, how come the state or the feds never copied it? On a second note, here we go with proper, non-proper forest management. Thanks. Love your show. Signed, Douglas. Here's the answer. That 747 global supertanker could have been out there fighting fires. Years ago, it finally was simply technology that they gave up on. Even though the technology was proven, it worked, it was certified by the FAA and every other agency that had to certify it. It was the largest water or retardant dropper or bomber on the globe. And there was only one like it. And they could have had one that would have served many of the needs of the United States. And they could have based it in a central location like, say, Colorado Springs, where it was based for a period of time. And it could have been anywhere in the lower 48 states within about 3.5 to 4 hours. It could have been in Alaska in about 5 hours, could even get out to Hawaii. It could literally reach places on other sides of the planet. And if they ever used it the way it should have been used, there would have been justification to build at least one or two more of them. And I've had people say they're not maneuverable enough. That was simply not true. They were. And I talked to the pilots who actually flew that airplane, and they all said because of the way it was engineered, because of the relatively low weight of the water that they were carrying, because remember, a 747 is designed to carry hundreds and hundreds of passengers and cargo and their luggage and everything else. The amount of water and equipment it was carrying was relatively small. And they could fight fires just about everywhere in the United States. And I had people say to me, well, you know, it isn't for every situation. Well, aircraft in firefighting are not for every situation. For helicopters, they're great in some fires, terrible in others. Fixed wing aircraft, same kind of problem. But there were enough occasions where they could have used it. And the U.S. Forest Service was never forced to explain why aren't you willing to use this aircraft. So it went out of existence. The company that had bought all the technology from the old Evergreen Aviation Company, the one that built it, Dell Smith, had put all that together. They finally just gave up. They said, we can't get enough customers to hire us to do the job. So therefore, we're going to simply give up. They took all the equipment off the plane. The plane went back into service as a 747 cargo plane, and that was pretty much the end of it. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question today, Should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? My answer to that would be yes. It's an idea, and I think it's a brilliant one, from the current Republican nominee for governor in the state of Oregon, and that's Christine Drazen. She was not my first choice as governor, but she's a whole heck of a lot better than Tina Kotek. And why is she suggesting this idea? Because Initiative Petition 28 came very, very close to making the ballot. And what did it propose? It proposed to end all fishing, all hunting, all ranching, all raising of animals to provide food for human beings. In other words, you weren't going to be able to, if Initiative Petition 28 had made the ballot and had been passed by a majority in Oregon, farmers and ranchers would have been forbidden to slaughter chickens, slaughter cows, slaughter pigs, or any other animals that were used for food. They'd also be very constrained in doing any kind of animal husbandry. So Christine Drazen and a group of Republicans have said it is time to introduce a measure to the state legislature, a resolution in 2027 that would make a constitutional amendment to the state constitution, not the federal, that would guarantee fishing and hunting access. I think it's a brilliant idea, and I can't wait for the first reporter who catches up to Governor Tina Kotek, member of the Democrat Party, and says to her, where do you stand with regard to a constitutional amendment to protect the rights of fishing and hunting for Oregon citizens? If Tina Kotek says, I'm not in favor of it, can you imagine the message you're sending to voters? You're not in favor of protecting the right of people in the state of Oregon, where you're the governor, to be able to go fishing and hunting. On the other hand, if she says she is in favor of it, then she's effectively endorsing an idea that is coming from her opponent. So, should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? My answer to that would be yes. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Final issue that I want to bring up this segment, and that is, should cities like Seattle turn their CCTV systems back on and even add more cameras, especially after incidents like the mass shooting at the Bight of Seattle? Do you know that the police suspect there is a third shooter who may have actually been the one who fired the shots that both hurt and wounded people at the Bight of Seattle on July 26th? Do you know why they haven't found him yet? Because they don't know what he looks like. If the CCTV cameras had been in operation, they might well have been able to identify the person who is the third suspect, but they don't. In the aftermath of the shooting, they say cameras might have been able to help the police. There were no cameras other than the body-worn cameras by police officers. The latest controversy involves Katie Wilson's July 7th directive to power down the stadium district cameras right after the end of the World Cup competition. And they said, we have to have privacy and civil liberties. Do you realize Katie Wilson is a communist? Katie Wilson is a terrible mayor. Katie Wilson makes bad decisions for the people. But now she's telling you that when you're in a very, very public place, like the Chinatown International District or at the Bight of Seattle, that that's where you have to protect people's privacy? Is in a place where there is no privacy and everything you're doing is in public? If this is what passes for leadership, I can't wait for the reporter who asks Katie Wilson, when do you plan to submit your resignation? Because it's long overdue. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News
10. Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lies.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's going to be a real pleasure, I think, in November when John Braun wins and beats and takes out Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez as a member of Congress. I think that's going to happen in the November election. We got a preview of that last night. And I now welcome to the program John Braun, who is currently Washington Senate Republican leader, but also part of the top two finishers in the jungle primary to run off against Perez this coming November. John, congratulations to you. And I know you probably saw more recent numbers than I have. It looked as though you and Perez were running almost exactly the same percentage of the vote in last night's voting.
Oh, Lars, thanks for having me on. I'm certainly happy to see the results from last night. It's a couple hundred votes different. I just checked before I got on, and there hasn't been an update that affected the third congressional so far today. I expect there to be something here in the near future, and we have every indication we're going to get more Republican votes in later votes. That's typically how it works in Southwest Washington. We'll see. I don't want to presume anything, but I think we're in great shape. The most telling item is, after spending, $4.5 million and the incumbent, who everybody knows, has been elected twice, had 60%, over 60% of the voters say no thank you. So I think that's very telling, a clear path for us to go win in November, but it's going to be tight. We got a lot of work to do.
Well, in fact, to have her do that poorly in an election in which it seemed in other parts of the country, the Democrat Socialists of America, the DSA, and the extreme left wing end of the Democrat Party seemed to do better than a lot of people thought they ever would, could have, didn't they?
Well, yeah, and if you look her anything from her website to her statements to her votes, she has been moving to the left steadily to try to line herself up with the current Democratic agenda, which is heavily influenced, as you suggest, by the Democratic Socialists. I mean, the Democratic Party is moving to the left. She is with them. She is going to been very clear. She's going to vote for Hakeem. If elected, she'd vote for Hakeem Jeffries, who's going to bring a Democrat agenda driven by the Democratic Socialists of America right now.
And John, is that a smart strategy when she's in a district like the third congressional district that is one of those purple districts? It's not solidly blue. It's not solidly red. It's a bit in the middle, and has been for a long time. That's why the old incumbent, who was there, did reasonably well and then was replaced by Perez when Joe Kent failed to perform. I mean, we need to fix this, but I would think you would want her to run as far to the left as possible because the third congressional district is not King County. It's not Seattle, is it?
Yeah, that's right. And I think this effort, her ineffectiveness, she claims to try to pull people in the middle, but she's not been effective there. So that she needs the vote. So she's moving to the left. I think that's good for me. I think that will help, independents see that she's not the right fit for the district. I'm running a very independent campaign. I've been very clear. I'm a common sense conservative, but I believe in, pragmatism and solving people's problems. And while she claims to want to do that, her actions speak otherwise. She is very much beholden to the far left and has given every indication she'll support their agenda while claiming not to support their agenda. It's kind of a strange strategy.
Well, it is. I'm talking to John Braun. And by the way, I would talk to Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez anytime she's willing to come on the show. But I've also suggested I think she's a bit of a phony, both in the way she presents herself to the public, that she's some kind of, grease monkey, worked in an automobile repair shop, and that wasn't the case. And then when she gets into Congress, she's voted for higher taxes. She voted against the Trump tax cuts, but thankfully they went through, and now, families in Washington state are paying taxes that are thousands of dollars lower because of those cuts. She voted against that. She's been silent on Washington state's 9.9% income tax, the so-called millionaire tax. She isn't willing to say where she stands on that either. I hope you're planning to make it a fairly big issue, John.
Absolutely. I mean, in spite of her claims to the contrary, she has not been on the side of individuals struggling with affordability issues. She's very pro-tax. She's not been on the side of small businesses. She voted against the small business tax credit in HR 1 last year. So her words, you know, do not line up with her actions, and it's going to be a key part of our campaign that she's been ineffective in getting material things done in Congress. She's been on the wrong side of the issues, on tax issues, on energy issues, on national security issues. And I think the difference in our campaign is we're going to see significant exposure of these votes to the broader public that just frankly didn't happen in the last two cycles.
Well, it sounds like she's not, even the Democrats aren't that happy with her. The numbers she has among Democrat voters are about 69% approval rating, which suggests her own party isn't very happy with her at all. And that's a great opportunity for you, I would think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, politics is the business of addition, right? We're going to go try and win votes, and I'm not going to change the principles to do that, but we really believe that Republicans right now have better policies to help average working-class Washingtonians live better lives and better lives for their families, better for their communities. We just got to go communicate that to voters around Southwest Washington.
And by the way, John, I have to tell you, folks, I've talked to John probably dozens of times over the last few years, but I've never actually met the man in person. And then I happened to be in Kathlamet during Bald Eagle days, and there walking in the parade is John Braun. So I walked out and I said hello to John. That was the first time you and I had ever met in person in my recollection.
You're right. I wouldn't have recognized who you introduced yourself. I really appreciate you doing that. It was great to see you there. We've been out to parades and community events all over Southwest Washington. That was a particularly fun one there in Kathlamet.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what Marie Perez does, because I don't think she's done that well. She's had some of her own town halls where she's had to cancel because some members of her party think she's not far enough to the left. And then when she shows up and acts far enough to the left, then, of course, that estranges her from everybody else in her district. So she's got a real tightrope to walk, and I don't think she can get it done.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't work to try to be all things to all people. I mean, I have a record of just pragmatic and common sense conservative, but focused on getting results. Instead, she's trying to you know, present, you know, the right answer to everybody despite where they're coming from. And it just, people see through that over time.
Yeah, they sure do. John, you want to tell people where they can find your social media and your website so they'll know more about your campaign? Because I want you to beat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez in November.
Absolutely. Thanks, Lars. You know, so it's votebraun.com, VOTEBRAUN.com. That gives you all the information about our campaign, about the issues. It will provide links to social media, but also if you go on X or Instagram or Facebook and just you search for Vote Braun, it'll pop our account up, and you're welcome, encouraged, please, to follow us in any of those. We're out and about all over Southwest Washington doing stuff, engaging with folks, listening to their challenges, virtually every day, proud to do it, and I look forward over the next few months to earning votes across Southwest Washington and winning this race.
You got it. That's John Braun running for the United States Congress to take the 3rd congressional seat. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Need reading glasses.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to go to phone calls, but in a moment, I want to tell you about some new information we've got about what the FBI was doing. You remember the one Russia hoax that was run by Hillary Clinton and the DNC against Donald Trump? Well, when the FBI busted that one, they then opened up a brand new investigation that suggested that Donald Trump was nothing but a Russian stooge. I'll get into that in just a moment, the new information we actually know. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And let me go to Eric. Eric may or may not be one of our favorite kinds of callers, and that is a naysayer. So, Eric, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Hey, I'm not sure if we do, Lars. I may be a skeptic and need a clarification. So
okay.
You mentioned you're against the you're hoping that the filibuster is abolished for legislative stuff.
Yep.
Currently, but I remember back in 2022, January, there was a vote to do the same thing going the other way for another voting rights-type legislation where senators voted 52 to 48, all Republicans plus Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, to stop that filibuster from being blown up. And I've searched your archives, and I can't find any comment on that from you, but I'm wondering if your attitude was the same at that point, or if you came out vehemently saying, hey, filibuster is not a Democratic sort of way to run the Senate.
I think that's always been my point of view, and I've had plenty of warnings from, you know, old hands in politics, because this is the standard way they'll answer it. They'll say, Lars, we've been in politics forever, and if you get rid of the filibuster because you want to get something passed today, you're going to be sorry you did a year from now or 5 years from now, because something will get through that we, the other side, might have been able to stop when you're in the minority. Because the filibuster only works well for the minority party, except now the Democrats have figured out how to make it work for them when they're in the minority. Does that make sense? And to me, if you're going to have representative government, and that's what we have, the Democrats are constantly harping that we're a democracy. We are not a democracy. We do not have Democratic votes on any of the biggest and most important issues. Even choosing the president is not democracy. It is through the Electoral College and a representative form. And when it comes to writing our laws, we have the laws written by the House, the Senate, and the president's signature. Again, that's representative government. That is not direct democracy. Now, do we have some elements of democracy? Sure, because in most states you vote on who's going to be in the House, who's going to be in the Senate. You know, you vote to decide which electors are going to vote for either, you know, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, depending on the year, or Donald Trump or Joe Biden, and all that. But tell me how this works. If you have representative government, but then one of the bodies that's supposed to represent you adopts its own rule that says a majority vote on something is not enough. 51 or 52 votes is not enough. You have to have 60 votes. And they effectively excuse themselves from making any kind of decisions by saying, we don't have to decide unless one side or the other gets 60 votes. On anything really tough, we don't have to make a decision. And that's what they've done. And it actually works to the benefit of both the Republican Party and the Democrat Party, because when the Democrats are in the minority, they can stop things. When the Democrats are in the majority, they can say, oh, we would love to pass this, but we can't because we don't have 60 votes. So it gets them out of actually doing their jobs. And it means that when Americans say, hold on, we went to the polls, all of us, 350 million of us or so, and we voted in a Senate that was 51 or 52 or 53 votes Democrat or Republican, and yet the parties are telling us we still can't pass legislation because you have to have 60 votes because of a rule that was invented not by the American people, but by the Senate itself. How is that representative government?
Yeah, I see what you're saying there, and you hit the nail on the head with the comparison to, say, you know, the Electoral College, et cetera. There are many places where it's not a sheer majority that, you know, makes the decision in our current form of government. To me, this I see the logic behind the filibuster.
You do. Tell me what it is then. Tell me what it is then.
Well,
Because if you have a majority of Americans who support something and their representatives go to D.C. and they say, we represent the majority who are in favor of the SAVE Act, for example, and we number 51 or 52 in the Senate, you say, well, then it's going to become law. You say, no, it can't become law because of this other rule. What's the logic of that?
Well, I think it's the same logic as you would see with, like, the Electoral College. The Senate's supposed to be the cooling off spot for legislation. And back in the days when, you know, Congress used to work somewhat together, there were times when there were more than 60 senators.
Except for one thing, there's geography involved in the Electoral College. And here's why. If tomorrow, Eric, the presidency was decided by the popular vote, right? Just by votes. How many cities would a candidate have to campaign heavily in to win the presidency? 10? Maybe 12?
I totally understand that. I totally understand that.
Okay, so that's the purpose it serves.
I agree with the electoral college.
It means you can't run for president and say, I don't give a damn about Montana or Wyoming. I don't care about Oklahoma. I don't care about North or South Dakota. They are inconsequential. I care about the big population centers. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston, Miami, Dallas, and Houston. That's what I care about. The rest of the country can go to blazes.
Right.
You can't do that because of the Electoral College. But how is that function comparable to the Senate saying a majority of Americans, and right now, you and I both know, the SAVE Act is supported by a majority of Americans. It's almost a majority of Democrats who support it. And the Senate says, nope, we don't have to approve it. Is that representative government?
Yeah, I don't think it's 100% representative government.
It either is or it isn't. You can't be, well, it's kind of representative. It either is or it isn't, isn't it?
Okay, if we're going to use that definition, then the electoral
Can you be a little bit pregnant? Can you be mostly pregnant?
Right.
Or are you either pregnant or not pregnant?
Come on, Lars. That's a straw man. I mean, that's...
No, it's not. It's saying, can you be a little bit unrepresentative? No, you either represent the people of this country or you don't represent them. But you're a great naysayer. Eric, thanks for the call. You got the Lars.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's new Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk@LarsLarson.com. That's talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Medicaid has spent more than $5 billion on autism therapy in just the last 6 years. It's a stunning number. Are more kids actually being diagnosed, or is fraud driving up the cost of some of that aid? I thought we'd check in with Taylor Sanders, who's with the Autism Family Alliance. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I know I've introduced that in a way that some people might find pejorative, but the idea is this autism therapy actually doing folks with autism any opportunity for Medicaid to be billed and defrauded of money? Because that's a big problem in the United States as well. And ultimately, every dollar that goes to fraud is a dollar that can't go to help somebody who has legitimate problems like autism.
Right. Yeah, I think the first place to start is to understand ABA is such an amazing science. It is here to be able to support families, especially those on the autism spectrum disorder, with helping increase, you know, communication, helping increase some of those safety skills and reduce some of those challenging behaviors. Taxpayers absolutely deserve to know where their money is being used and if it's being used responsibly. Anybody that is engaging in fraudulent behaviors should be prosecuted.
So how do you know if they're doing that? When you mentioned ABA, that's applied behavioral analysis. Is that right? Would you mind telling my audience what that is?
Yeah, of course. Applied behavior analysis. So it is a scientific therapy that applies learning and behavior principles to help improve socially significant everyday actions.
What does that mean? How does that translate? Because most of us are not psychologists or psychiatrists or experts in treatment of things like autism. How does that actually work?
Yeah, great question. I think the best way to go into this is by an example. A lot of people that come to ABA or seeking ABA services have a child that's on the spectrum. So it can range from helping them increase their communication skills. So having a two-year-old who has not said any of their first words, collaborating with a speech pathologist, OT, and a BCBA, which is a board-certified behavior analyst, to help get that child to speak and communicate, to decrease challenging behaviors. We've seen some kiddos who come into ABA and they start with severe wrist biting to the point of, you know, severe damage that's happening. And then through ABA, teaching them how to better communicate their wants and needs, we've seen a significant decrease in some of those challenging behaviors.
Okay, so where does the fraud come into this? Is some of this being done legitimately, but other folks have figured out how to gimmick the system and get money when they're really not doing legitimate ABA that helps people?
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, you know, this service is here to serve others. Most of the clinicians that are in this field want to be able to protect these kiddos on the spectrum, to help increase independence, those safety skills, reduce the challenging behaviors, be a support system for the parents. And so when we're getting into conversations of, is this, you know, just a money field, it shouldn't be. And those people that are treating it like that should absolutely be prosecuted.
Okay, but when you say it shouldn't be just a money field, when they say between 2018 and 2024, so that's a six-year period, Medicaid providers paid up $5.15 billion under one of the primary billing codes for ABA therapy. So that one therapy in a six-year period was worth $5 billion. That's a lot of money. And is it justified by what patients were actually getting in the way of therapy from treatment people? How do we know what part of that was legit and what part of it was phony and fraudulent?
Right. I think, you know, financial incentive can always create those risks, which is why independent oversight is so important. But unethical practices do not represent all of ABA. So ethical treatment should be based on the child's needs. So bringing it back to individualizing treatment and making sure that we're ruling out those that are engaging in those fraudulent activities versus the companies that are truly here to support these children trying to access services.
Okay, but is there any simple way of saying, how do you tell the difference? Because one of the things I noticed in some of the coverage of this is they say when they look at that one billing code for ABA therapy, they said some of the claims equated to hundreds of dollars per minute of therapy based on a standard 15-minute billing unit, which sounds, I mean, hundreds of dollars per minute? What is there about this therapy that makes it worth that much money? And can you tell whether or not that's a fraudulent claim for ABA, whereas there are other claims that maybe that are legitimate? How do you tell the difference?
It can be tricky. It's important to recognize and understand what an ethical practice looks like. So in terms of ABA, and if any parents are out there listening, it's important to look for if that company is individualizing care to the child, and understanding that an ethical provider will never put a certain number on a kiddo every single time. There is a lot of argument between, well, I'm getting diagnosed 30 hours and 40 hours, and the company is telling me that I need to have 40 hours of ABA. That shouldn't be the case. We need to be focused on meaningful quality of life outcomes that is supported by the objective data. Starting to bring in clinicians and stakeholders into these conversations of fraud so we can better tackle this issue while still protecting, you know, the taxpayers' money and the children that are receiving these services.
Well, I'm talking to Taylor Sanders from the Autism Family Alliance. So is there a role to play for the families of people with autism? Because if they see a provider that says, hey, we're going to do a lot for your family member, but we're going to have to sign up for this many hours of things, should some of those families be raising the alarm and say, no, this doesn't sound legitimate, and then turning it in so that Medicaid can find that fraud?
Right, exactly. I think that's one point to be said. When something feels off, when there's not any information or reasoning as to why a number is so high, we can go in by asking for questions. What exactly are you going to be doing with this time? What are you focusing on? What should I be seeing within this next 6 months? How are you going to show me this progress? What will it look like? And how am I involved with this process? And how is what's happening in my life being reviewed when we are going through designing a treatment plan for ABA?
And Taylor, are they seeing enough positive results from ABA, this applied behavior analysis, that is worth that kind of money?
Oh, yeah. I think that's one of the main reasons why we've seen some of these numbers increase. Of course, there might be other things happening outside of our control, but I also strongly believe that a big number as to why we've seen such a boost is because families are seeing how much ABA has made an impactful difference in their life.
Hey, Taylor, thank you very much. I appreciate the work you do for families with autism.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me, Lars.
You bet. That's Taylor Sanders. She's with the Autism Family Alliance. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Heater quits or your
missed the Lars Larson show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson show. Well, the X poll question today: should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? I'd answer that one yes. It is being proposed in the state of Oregon. I don't happen to be a voter in the state of Oregon. I vote in the state of Washington. But would I like to see the right to hunt and fish and to farm and ranch and be able to kill animals to provide food for human beings? That was the idea that Initiative Petition 28 was going to bring to an end. Thankfully, Initiative Petition 28 could not get the required number of signatures necessary to put it on the ballot. But this is the third time that a group has tried to get that measure on the ballot. It does not mean, in fact, it is almost certain that they will be back to try to get it on the ballot again. And when they do, I've had plenty of people say, Lars, even Oregon voters are not crazy enough to vote for something like that. To which I would tell them, number one, ballot measure 110, the legalization of hard drugs in Oregon. Yeah, I realize the legislature has undone much of that. But for a couple of years, Initiative Petition 110 was enough to kill hundreds and hundreds of people in the state of Oregon. And it was passed by a substantial margin of voters who voted yes on it. So if you tell me, no, people aren't crazy enough to vote for that, yes, they are. Now, if Initiative Petition 28 is tried again, I think what it should run into is a state constitutional amendment that simply says you can't take away hunting and fishing rights. Those belong to the people. And if you try to take them away, that would be unconstitutional. Although, I wouldn't put it past Oregon. Right now, the state Supreme Court is deciding whether or not ballot measure 114 is going to take away the Second Amendment rights of people to keep and bear arms. And you know, the state Supreme Court, I think, is going to sit on that measure until after the election. Shame on them. The X poll today: should citizen rights to hunt and fish get state constitutional protection? My answer to that would be yes. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Bob. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Bob. Lars.
Sure.
I'm not going to obey IP28. And I urge other Oregonians not to do it as well. When stupid politicians pass stupid laws, you know, there's just no getting around it. I'm not going to obey that law. I live in Oregon. I don't live in Manhattan. I can see that law in Manhattan, someplace like that. But in Oregon, I'm sorry.
Hold on, Bob.
I'm no longer obeying stupid laws.
Bob, here's the problem.
Yeah.
Number one, IP28 is not a law. It's a proposal that was going to be put to a vote if it got enough signatures. It didn't. But
right.
If it does,
right.
And I suspect that some year, the first 2 years, they didn't even come close. This last time, they came very close. I suspect that in the next couple of years, they'll probably figure out how to get enough signatures, and they'll put it to a vote. And in that case, it won't be stupid politicians who pass it. If it's passed, you know who will have approved that law if it becomes law, Bob? It'll be average citizens who are simply voting. And if you say, well, people vote for stupid things, I won't abide by that law. The problem is, unlike a lot of laws that are passed by initiative, this one would be enforced by the state. So if the state says it is illegal to kill animals for any reason, it won't be about you obeying the law and saying, oh, I'll go along with that rule. What would happen is, number one, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife would say, we're no longer going to sell fishing or hunting licenses in the state of Oregon. We're no longer going to sell salmon tags or elk tags or buck deer tags. We're not going to sell those tags anymore. And then if you put that law on the books, Oregon's Department of Agriculture would be expected to enforce the law, and they would go out to the pig farmer and the chicken farmer and the beef rancher, and they would say, you're no longer allowed to kill your animals, and the state would do the enforcement of that law. I don't like it, but that's how it would work. So it wouldn't be about you complying with the law. It'd be about, you know, the people of Oregon casting their votes and ordering the state to shut down every ranch, every chicken ranch, every beef ranch, every pig ranch in the state, shut down all hunting, all fishing, shut down all, you know, predator control, shut down all of that stuff. So how would your refusal to go along with the law make a difference if it's the state agencies that are going to be doing most of the enforcing?
Oh, great question. Glad that you asked that. I think, you know, my voice right now, other people hearing somebody's going to push back, somebody's not going to obey stupid laws, will inspire other people to push back. That's the whole premise of me calling in today.
Okay, but then what happens when the guy who's raising beef cows, and he says, I'm still going to kill my cows, I'm still going to produce hamburger and steak, and then the state comes along, and since the IP-28 would have made it a criminal act to kill an animal and turn the animal into chicken sandwiches or steaks, and you'd have the state arresting people and charging them and putting them on trial. How are you going to resist that?
Well, the state can't find its own you-know-what. So for them to put some kind of effort to corral and police that, that's going to be extremely difficult. And aside from that, it's going to create a different economy. It's going to create an underground economy that people are going to do that.
Hold on, Bob. I think you've mistaken what they'd plan to do. You would still find steak for sale and chicken for sale in Oregon, but it could not be raised here and it could not be killed here. So you'd end up having to truck it in from California, from Washington, from Idaho, from other places, and all those foods would become much more expensive when you buy them in the state of Oregon because you can no longer produce them in the state. That makes sense?
Which emphasizes my argument. It does, but which supports my argument. It will create an underground economy. People will not obey it. They'll find ways. You know this, Lars. They'll find ways to hide, skirt around, whatever it takes to hunt and fish. This is Oregon.
Well, you may be right, but remember what they do. If they outlaw all hunting and all fishing, then it's not going to be very difficult for the government to run up and down the rivers and cite and arrest every single person who's out there with a fishing pole catching fish, because all of them under IP-28, if it ever passes someday, all of them will be viewed as criminal killers of animals. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 10.